I think it's a problem of the zine community making that, and I think it's also a problem in the organizing community, because, well, I'm writing an article right now with a friend about like how organizing communities don't support art, art people, artistic people, like political arts. We're not supporting it. So what do you expect? People don't want to do it. Like after a moment, or they want to do something different. And I think that's a problem for also organizing communities.
Well, why do you think that is? Like, why do you think political art isn't being supported?
Because I think political art is seen as something as a bourgeois, and something like a luxury, and something as an illustration for the message. And the message being the political ideology, and art is only something that is going to make it more beautiful. It's not seen as a way to think things otherwise.
And why do you think that in Montreal the zine community is Anglophone-centric? Like, what is contributing to that?
Well, I think that the zine community in general, what I've seen also in Europe, is very Anglophone-centric. In Europe is different, it's because there are so many languages that is a language that many people understand.
Yeah.
And I think in Northern America it's because it's the main language. So people, even Francophone, thinks that if they want to be read by the majority of the people, they have to write in English. You know, and so I think it's true. So there's not false, it's just you have to choose, and then we're choosing to write for the majority and not to write to use a language. And I think the language is a vehicle of a culture. So we're not allowing the Francophone community or the Hispanophone communities to create cultures of their own.
That does it for These Things That People Make today. Once again, check out Coco Riot's work for You Even Queers, and this is about having an accent, at CocoRiot.com. You Even Queers is going to be coming to Toronto with the book launch, and I will be spreading that information on my blog and elsewhere, so watch for that. And part of the interview that I didn't air talks about Coco's animation film, so check out more information on CocoRiot.com. About that animation film. I also want to just let my listeners know that I'm going to be taking a summer break from these things that people make. So we'll be on a little bit of a hiatus so that I can make a radio documentary about my lesbian aunts who live in the Adirondacks. If you want to get in touch with me over the summer, you can send me an email, sarah.mangle@gmail.com, or you can check out the blog and go from there. These things that people make .blogspot.com. I hope everyone has a fabulous summer.
So I'm talking with Anna.
Chew this up. CFRU 93.3 FM, your local community radio in Guelph.
Radio, sucker, never
The CRTC has just recently made a decision to revoke the FM broadcast license of our sister station, CKLN. As Toronto's oldest campus community station, CKLN has been broadcasting since 1983. If you are listening to this station, then you probably understand the importance of community access radio. Please help support our sister station. Find out how you can keep CKLN on the air by visiting their website, www.ckln.fm.
For the latest adventures in modern music, listen to Sounds from the Tall House with your host, Michael Mucci. Every other Sunday from 10 a.m. to 12 noon, right here on CFRU 93.3 FM.
Guelph's first ever LGBTQ and Aging Conference will take place this June the 22nd at the Victoria Park West Golf Club, 1159 Victoria Road South. The event will feature an emotional and groundbreaking documentary called Gen Silent about the barriers that LGBTQ persons face when they enter care facilities. A discussion with the filmmaker will follow. We will hear from a panel of LGBTQ persons who will discuss their experience accessing healthcare in our region. there will be a short presentation on HIV and its treatment in the context of aging. And we will look at what some of our local elder care facilities are already doing to address these issues. The LGBTQ and Aging Conference is being organised by the AIDS Committee for Guelph. For more information and to register for the conference, please visit their website at www.aidsguelph.org. That's www.aidsguelph.org.
This is Walter Garrison, the host of Locavore on CFRU 93.3 FM, broadcast out of Guelph, Ontario. And today is Thursday, June 16th, and we are going to be interviewing Martha Gay Scroggins and Anna Mancuso from the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming. And specifically, what I'm going to be talking with them about is the crop mob that they had on Saturday, June 4th, a couple of weeks ago. Now, I've interviewed Martha Gay before, and the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming is a 2.5-acre farm situated on the University of Guelph campus. They grow certified organic food using permaculture techniques, and the GCUOF is intended to foster hands-on learning in sustainable food production. And they welcome volunteers all the time to work, and they're planting furiously now. It's been a late spring, very dark and cold and wet. We're now finally in the last week and a bit getting some warm, sunny weather, which is allowed for planting. And I'll give the website for the GCUOF. It's HTTP /gcuof.wordpress.com. Okay, so the first part of my interview, I'll be talking with Anna about her work at the GCUOF and also being a student in the organic major. So I'm talking with Anna Mancuso from the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming. Okay, so we're here in the middle of a very intense thunderstorm. Anna, can you talk to us about how the planting is designed for the organic farm here? Very interesting schedule, I see.
Well, our schedule is guided, at least, by the biodynamic planting calendar, which takes into account sort of the phases of the moon and the location of the planets and the stars in the sky. Okay. And I am definitely not an expert on biodynamic farming, okay, but a lot of farmers will tell you that keeping these things in mind, like when there's going to be a full moon, for example, is very helpful in determining whether your crops will do well. And just by testing the system out and through experience, the farmers that I'm working with are quite sure that there are definite benefits to following this system.
So we're in the month of June right now. Can you explain your planting schedule for the month of June?
Well, the biodynamic calendar is sort of organized according to root, flower, fruit, and leaf days. So on a root day, you would want to plant things like potatoes or carrots or radishes. On a flower day, beans and peas are considered flowers, so is something like okra that has quite a significant flower on it. Leaves, obviously, are things like lettuce or spinach or Swiss chard. Broccoli, I should say, is also in the flower category. And fruit includes things like tomatoes or peppers or melons that have a large edible fruit that you would want to harvest.
So I see this week coming up, so Monday is a leaf day, so you'd be planting, I see, what you're direct seeding purslane.
Yep.
And coriander, and then dill as well?
Dill and salad greens. That's our plan for Monday.
Okay. Now, Wednesday is a fruit day, so you're planting peppers and tomatoes and cucurbits that I see.
Yes. So we'll be, if the weather cooperates, and it's not right now, we'll be transplanting the bulk of our tomatoes and peppers, melons, and cucumbers.
Okay, and then we have two root days in a row on Thursday and Friday. So you're planting onions and what else?
We'll be planting onions on both of those days likely, and some radishes, possibly some carrots. We have tons of onion transplants just dying to be put in the ground.
So it'll be very interesting to see how these plants respond when you plant on these specific days.
Yeah, I haven't been farming long enough to really notice the difference, but I'm told that you really will start to perceive a difference in how well your crops do if you start to take these things into account.
Sounds like a great research project, actually.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, Anna was talking about the biodynamic calendar, and Martha Scroggins subscribes to this very assiduously, and she's going to talk about in the next part of the show about utilizing the biodynamic calendar. You're going to talk about the changes that have occurred since the last time I spoke with her at the GCUOF. It's her third year working on this project, and I remember being there starting out helping planting and preparing beds in the greenhouse and in the field. And I was part of the crop mob and have done some planting some leeks and onions, and planted a bunch of tomatoes as well, too, different cultivars, I should say, of tomatoes. And so there's certainly a lot of human power that is required for the successful operation of the urban organic farm. So in the next section of our show today, Martha Scroggins is going to talk about these changes that have occurred in the field, increasing production, the crops that are being grown this year, the student involvement with this project, about her perennial crops, and incorporating biodynamics into the production scheme. Okay, so I'm here at the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming, and it's a very rainy day. On Saturday, they're part of this crop mob. Okay, so I'm here at the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming, and it's a very rainy day. On Saturday, they're part of this crop mob. And I'm talking with Martha Gay Scroggins about the development of the farm here. I've talked with her earlier several months ago about the farm, and things have changed and progressed. So I guess, Martha, from the time that we talked before for the show, what have been some of the more notable changes that have occurred here?
Well, we have two full-time staff, which has been a great help to get the land prepared for a post-oil agricultural scenario, which is what we've been creating. Well, we made a call about 4 years ago to attempt to do this project without using any oil. Now, that's not, we have bought some plastic, but I'd rather not buy plastic, and I'd like to be able to have ground cover that could support weed control instead of plastic. But until we get to that point, without using a tractor, we need lots of human power, which is really horsepower now converted to human power, which is the HP, which is the energy required to the actual energy to turn land and prepare. Because when we would have been planted by now and would not have needed a crop mob today, even though I think the idea is terrific. I think it's a really brilliant way to bring community together. Yes. And see a project unfold. we would have been planted if we'd had a tractor. A tractor just comes and tills the, you know, you till the soil, you cultivate it, you disc it, you rake it and harrow it, whatever you have to do to make it a fine seeding bed or planting bed. We haven't that capability, so we have to dig it by hand. So in the preparation of the bed so far, we have about a quarter of the farm. The beds have been prepared by double digging, and we now have established, the beginnings of permanent culture beds, which those beds should really not need to be ever touched again. You don't walk in them. You just plant certain crops, you select certain crops, and then you rotate those crops, and you leave the residue from the crops from year to year. Some crops, like melons, have potassium in them. So the residue from those melons can decompose over time. We can then take the crop residue off and make compost with thistles, for instance, that are a huge problem for us as a weed. However, they are high in mineral. So how can we convert that weed situation into a positive, which is using it as compost making, because we don't have any animals here. So we have to use all vegetative matter to create nutrients, to put nutrient back in. So that's a huge challenge for us. Again, without a tractor, we're having to turn all of these big piles, windrow piles of compost by hand. So, hence the crop mop and the ideas that hopefully will follow through from that one.
So I noticed that you have the Lee Valley wheel hole with the other attachments, cultivator that goes on there as well. That would certainly assist in the non-fossil fuel endeavor.
We have, actually, Ken and Martha Lang from Orchard Hill Farm donated one wheel hoe that he'd made. We bought another one beginning of last season, so we ran what we ran. We ran with two last year, and we had bought an additional one this year. So they're terrific for weeding. They're not so good. You think you can use them for plowing, but they're not quite there yet. Some of the Swiss-made ones are. We could have some fundraisers, and if we could afford to buy, the best Swiss-made wheel hose, then we would have more of a plow, a hand plow, which is what we need to do.
So obviously much better than rototilling the soil. You're actually leaving the mycorrhizae and the soil biota intact, or as intact as it can be.
All intact. All we're doing is loosening the top surface and, pulling the weeds out. So now we're pulling thistles out just by hand, and believe it or not, we have quite a crop of thistle. But they come out quite easily. So, and that, I try to demonstrate through, it's going to take a couple of years, but how weed can become a positive attribute to a local, sustainable local farm.
Now, what are the goals for this year, the overarching goals?
To get the crops planted.
That's a good goal.
Starting point. We had decided that we would have a later season for actual harvest. So the end of our crops will be harvested. Not early tomatoes. We're not aiming for early tomatoes. We're aiming for late tomatoes and late crops when the students are back in September. So the bulk of our produce will be ready from September right through till Christmas.
Okay. Now that's what I was going to ask you, because I know you had the one day market on site of by the cannon at the university. And what are your plans this year to market the produce that you're growing here?
Well, we'd like to do that again from September through till Christmas. I don't know. It'd be lovely if it was inside, but also it depends on it's weather dependent. Crop science, in front of crop science, there may be a small market that will run there throughout the summer. We'll wait and just see what kind of produce we have available. It'd be nice to have a market right here. I'd love people to be able to just, stop by. I know it's out of the way, but that's the easiest thing for us, given that we're, it takes a lot of work to put the market together.
Right. Now, the students that you teach, they're part of the program and that you deal with. Where are they working this summer?
A few of them are here.
Okay.
two of them are here. And one is in the organic major. I've not taught her formally in class, but she's been an undergraduate research assistant for 2 years on the farm. And so lots of familiar faces around, which really builds a pretty strong community with who we have here, which is, makes a team effective when we all have to plan, we all have to work very hard, especially right now. This is critical. This is showtime in the year, what you can plant, everybody knows we've had a really late cold May, of which I've never seen the likes of before. I've never seen such a dark
highly unusual.
Dark spring. So lack of sun has been detrimental to plants. I hope that people have covered up their annuals that they've planted out. This is going to be really pretty tough on them. It's been going down to 6 in the evening. This eggplant, tomatoes, they're not happy. So the planting season it's a critical time of the year.
This year could be later. It may be your plan may exactly dovetail with the environmental conditions.
Well, it may, and maybe it'll hold off tomato blight. And we've been here, this is our third season, and we've had blight for 2 years in a row. We've had quite a bit of plant disease. So we'll see this, but we may end up with all kinds of fungal problems this year because it's been so wet. Then again, Environment Canada said it's going to be hot and dry. So who knows? Climate change it's here. It's real. And I think farmers are now starting to talk about it more and more. They've not wanted to talk about it. They go, in 1860, we had, torrential rains or frost in July. Yes, rare. The time gap between those occurrences were further apart. Now we're close together, and it's becoming, I think we're having as farmers to be a little bit lighter on our feet as to how we change and always have options or secondary planting. Like, don't plan for one crop, diversify your plantings.
I definitely think that when you look at what's happened in Manitoba this year or in Alberta, the climate definitely has influenced these events, whether it be fire or heavy flooding. And certainly, when we look at food security, I would think people have to be thinking about that a lot more, because we won't see this until a few months now, but I think food prices are going to be higher because of what's happened climatically, not only in Canada, but around the world.
I can't tell you how incredibly... it wasn't a satisfaction it was about survival. Let me just start with that. When we planted parsnips and salsify and carrots, and they're in the ground and they're doing well. So there's a root crop that I know we're going to have. With any luck, we will have that crop to eat in the fall and into winter. So we're planning, you're seeding it now, and you're walking away, you're weeding it, looking after it, as required. It's that planting for the future. And how many perennial crops can I get in, like salsify and parsnips? That's the beauty about those two crops in particular. They just start to reseed themselves. And that's the essence behind permaculture, is to create a permanent agriculture that you can start to then rely on, that so you know that there's going to be food in the ground 10 years from now.
And this is the thing that I noticed. Oh, we have water dripping right now. We're trying to collect it. Now we're catching it, and this is part of the whole ethos here, trying to use as much as you can as what nature provides. Now, I remember being here close to not right at the beginning, but helping prepare, really rough land, and now you see permanent beds, and you see many perennial crops. Do you want to talk about the perennial crops that you do have here and how they're doing?
They're doing great, and they were all started from seed and or cuttings from my permaculture garden at home. They're thriving in bringing just increasing of biodiversity, and really it's companion planting for a lot of crops. Now we're collecting seed from those crops. So as I move a field of cabbage to another location, I can start to put perennial in those areas. So because we know that hyssop is a very strong supporting plant for all of the brassicas. So if we can reduce the sweet, we have to contend with here sweet midge and all of the cabbage worms and the loopers.
So hyssop really acts as a,
it does. It's strong, and those particular insects are deterred by it.
So the exudates from that plant. That's really
exactly. So that's really the why we have perennial. But not only that, we have to eat now. We have right in the garden. We have 3 years parsley coming up. And it's just a sea of green, fresh green parsley that we did not have to seed or transplant. It's just there, and it's a beautiful. There's no work involved. There's some knowledge base, but virtually it's there. So we have sorrel, chives, sage, the hyssops family, the mint families. All that food's out there right now for us to be consuming, and virtually with no work.
Now, I also noticed Anna talked about biodynamic planting. Can you talk about incorporating that into your production?
Oh, it's essential. I follow it, particularly for seeding. I've had a lot of opposition with workers over, you know, the last 10 or 12 years that I've been following, that I've been working with the calendar. It took me... I knew that I needed all the help that I could get to farm organically with absolutely no input, virtually no input, with open pollinated seed. So we needed the seed. I want to grow food that is high quality in nutrition, that tastes terrific, has a good shelf life, can potentially transport. So with all of those factors, I needed all the help I could get. So the biodynamic planting calendar was one way I thought it was worth a try. And it truly, I've been experimenting with it over the years. I've done all kinds of test results, and I've seen, we have some, it's okay. We have some video footage from somebody who has been supplying me with minerals, very concentrated minerals. That has also been something that I haven't been able to... I wouldn't have grown the food that I've grown without the use of the minerals. We've depleted our soils from minerals, particularly on corn, soy, any sort of land that we've come off of and we want to put back into practice or contaminate the lands in the city. I mean, that's another whole issue, but it can be dealt with. And I think the minerals, the planting calendar are too... principles that I adhere to. And the minerals I have a supplier of them. They're rare. They're not easily accessible. They're very, very expensive.
But a little, how are they applied to the soil?
I mix that with compost and dried seaweed and organic sugar or molasses. Sugar is easier to get, raw sugar. And I make a mix depending on what that crop needs. So if we're planting out the melons, then I will add a little bit of boron to that mix and more compost and a higher fish requirement. It just depends on what the crop needs. Some crops need more nitrogen. If we're growing leafy greens, we're going to use more fish. Though fishes haven't been too keen on using fish over the last few years just because the heavy metal concentrates and the toxins in the fish. In fact, they say it's been tested. I can often not get... If I can't find the source of the fish, then I won't use it.
Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you was about the support for the whole program here on the farm. How has that been lately? Because I know there had to be a certain amount of support to start this.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, have there been other institutions around the world that have talked to you about what you're doing? Because it is unique.
I hope so. I'm so entrenched with the daily task at hand that I sometimes don't stop and smell, the flowers. It's been a lot of it's a lot of work because it is this hands-on approach. So that being said, OAC, we are the academic or Rene Van Acker, who's he's the external funder, associate dean of OAC. Rene's been a tremendous support of this project, and I think that without his push and his drive and his trust that we're doing something, or his belief in that we're doing something that's positive for the community of the university and the community out there, it's been we're getting somewhere. I gave myself 3 years. I'm hoping by the end of this third year that we're in place then to start talking about this project and how can we replicate, or how can we then teach others around the areas wherever. I know they're all basic farming skills. It's about skill set.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time on this very rainy Saturday with all the work that obviously needs to be done.
It's quite comical today.
Yeah, yes, but good luck with the 2011 growing season.
Thank you very much.
Well, as you can hear in the background of that part of the interview, we had a tremendous amount of rain falling on the tarp that was outside the storage container that houses all of the tools for the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming. So apologize for that, but there's really nothing we can do about that. It was a very rainy day, and so... even though people arrived, it started to pour, and it put a damper on things for a while. However, as the sky cleared and the sun reappeared, then a number of new people came to help with weeding and enabling them to clear a substantial area of thistles at the farm. I also want to direct you to my own website, which has an archive of the shows, and